This is a home arrest parole hearing for Bryant Buckingham. Today we have with us on the board, we have four of our board members, the Honorable Luis Quinones, the Honorable David Neal, the Honorable Mrs. Gail Rittenhouse, and myself, Michael Johnson. I'm going to be acting as the hearing lead on this case this morning. Mr. Buckingham?
Yes, sir.
Sir, would you come up here? Yes, sir. Incarcerated, you did take quite a bit of program since you were incarcerated. You do have a program where you have certificates in here that you actually can. And according to the pre-sentence report, this is an incident that occurred when you went into a post office for the first time. You went into a post office, get some paper, and then you left. You came back a second time to get an envelope. You came back a third time waiting for the customers to actually leave. At this time, after the customers left, you then produced a weapon, fired it, and shot the postmaster's. Who was actually the victim in there, and then take some items out of there, and you left shortly after 3. It looks like you then took the victim's car, drove to California, to Laguna Beach, found out that the victim had died, and you went and turned yourself into the police department in Laguna Beach. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Yes.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about what was going on with you during that period of time and what's going on with you now, currently, the things that you're currently doing now.
Would you like me to
step up? Yes, sir, step up to them.
You want me to talk a little bit about around the 1990?
Yes, sir, when this incident occurred.
Yeah, I was a teenager at that time. I graduated high school and started working, but I just was kind of lost, and I had never been involved with any criminal activity or anything, but I was just kind of a lost kid, and I came up with this idea that I wanted to go live in the woods and just be away from everybody for a while. I was kind of inspired by some books I was reading, such as Henry David Thoreau's Walden and Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, books like these. And so it's hard to talk about now. It's a lot of, doesn't make sense. And as I look back on it, it's hard to put together logically, but I had these naive plans. But generally, I lived in Pennsylvania, and so I saved up some money. Like I said, my plan was to go live in the woods, and I came to the Rocky Mountains was the most isolated spot. So my goal was to pack up a motorcycle with camping gear and survival stuff. I was going to live off the land, which is totally, I wasn't prepared to do something like that, but anyway, I thought I could do it, and came across the country. I had money enough saved, and I had money with me, but eventually I had mechanical problems. I had to pay for a lot of stuff, and then as time went by, I'm looking for a place to finally drive my motorcycle up into the woods and start camping or something. And of course, I drove around and around all kinds of states, and I never found a spot. And during that time, I ran out of money, and I just was dealing with failure. And I gave myself, with this plan, I gave myself no exit plan. I just had this dream, and I was just very narrowly focused on it. And when it came, when I was down to desperation, I ran out of money. I quit. I was paying for gas instead of eating. So, I was in a very bad state of tiredness and a bad mental state. I was young, and then that's when I made the worst decision ever, which was I had weapons that I had never, when I left, my plan was never a crime or anything, never crossed my mind. I was planning to, I had weapons to live in the woods. I had a single shot shotgun, and I had a handgun, and those were just only for emergency in the woods to hunt small game and stuff. And during this time of riding around and failing, I said I was narrowly focused, and I became so desperate, I made that decision to, maybe I can rob somebody. I've never done anything such as this guy before. And the facts of the case made no sense when you look at it. It was a very confused set of things that I did, whether that was, the basics of what I did, go in there and shoot the stories and take that money. Terrible decision. I put myself in this mental state where I felt I was in a state of desperation to do or die, which is hard for me to look at now. It's totally, how I got there. There's a lot of bad decisions led up to that. But the thing is, as soon as that happened, as soon as I did that, I realized immediately that everything had changed. That I had affected. I could see the ramifications of that. A lot of people. I've heard before that a lot of people think change happens. Takes a lot of years. I think it does. Like if people are involved in drugs or something, or gangs, you get off the drugs and then you can kind of change your life. I never had any of that. I just had that very bad set of circumstances and bad decision. And so when I committed that crime, I immediately, after that, realized I changed right then. I was watching this documentary a while back, and it's a little bit, it made me think of this because it was about the atomic bomb and the Oppenheimer, who was the head of that commission, created the atomic bomb. And this guy was a genius guy, he was leading geniuses. And they were single-minded focused for years and years. And then, it seemed almost weird that as soon as he didn't realize that he was there until the bomb went off. And then he was like, oh my God, what did I do? What did he do? That's what he said after the bomb went off. This is the guy who worked to do that, but it didn't click in his mind how much devastation it was. He put him over himself. And that clicked with me, that's what happened to me, and that's why it really changed everything. After that incident, I saw immediately that was not the path that anybody should be in act as people that I should be doing or anybody should be doing. And that's why I turned myself in. That's why from day one in prison, I decided to take a certain path. I never joined gangs. I didn't do drugs. I tried to educate myself. I never went. There was no criminal behavior. This was a one-time criminal act. I've never had any criminal behavior in the last 28 and a half years since that incident. That's pretty hard in prison, as you guys surely know. You can get written up. You take a pencil from a school in prison. That's theft. There's theft, fraud, intimidation, assault, fighting, you name it, in prison. I don't have any. Zero criminal write-ups, zero criminal. I made that decision at that time, and I have stuck to that. I'm very proud of that part of my life, and I still do it today. The last 2.5 years I've been out. I've had some minor write-ups, and I have good days and bad days, but nothing even just ever, it's not even close, and it's never worked. I made that decision 28 and a half years ago, and I've stuck to that, and I'm very proud of these last years. I'm not proud of that incident, of course. That was the worst thing anybody could ever do. But there's absolutely no way that I could ever post one like that again.
So what do you, to tell us what has changed in your life? What are you doing with your life now? What's going on?
I'm living I would say the way a normal life, the way the world wants me to get out of prison after so many years, I have my own apartment, I have a full-time job with benefits, I have a retirement account that I started with the job, and since last time, for the first 2 years I've been in house arrest, one of the conditions was I couldn't drive an automobile or have a license. And the board looked at that last time, and they gave the discretion to the parole office, and the parole office let me pursue that. And so I was given that chance and responsibility to take it on. And so I focused on that. I ended up, I had to get my permit, and then I hadn't driven for so long. I actually went and bought a few hours of driving lessons and had an instructor with me. And then a friend took me to the driver's test. I got my license, and then I pursued looking for a car. So now I have a vehicle. Been driving, for about 3 or 4 months. I'm pretty normal. Been working a lot. Since last time, also, I had a cooking job in a golf course, which kind of slowed down during the summertime. So I was looking for another part-time job or more employment, and I ended up getting a good full-time job. But the golf course didn't run around the book. I gave my 2 weeks notice, and they said, you can work here as long as you want. And I went to that for about 2 months. I worked both jobs. So that was pretty much, doing a lot of work at that time. It became when things started picking up at the golf course, they really needed somebody full-time, so I couldn't have 2 full-time jobs. I had to let that one go. But so a couple of months I've been out of working, and then got the car to right after to do that stuff. Other than that, I'm living to the best I can. I have restrictions, I have a nice apartment, have a cat still, and trying to do the best I can.
So you volunteered to go get some, do some counseling. How's that going?
Yes, it's good. It's good to have somebody to talk to. I've always said since I've been out, I've had some kind of counseling. Some of it was given to me by DOC, which I completed. And then this, I've just been going to somebody voluntarily just in case there's anything that comes up that I can talk to freely about or whatever. This is nice to know.
As I see, you did have a report that came from the psychologist that you were going to see the counselor. How's that working out for you? How do you feel about that?
It's great. Like I said, it's somebody I can really say whatever to, and who really helps me focus on give me an outside perspective on how my emotions are, or how my things to do, or just because it's still a transition to be that much time in prison. It's still, things that I'm trying to just get better at still every day.
So, when you went through somebody back in the 90s, when you had this instance, you were having whether some family problems or some anger issues with your mom because you didn't get, she wouldn't help. Send you some money when you ran out of money, and it goes to there have been some issues back then. So all of those things have been resolved.
Oh yes, over the years, my family and I have really talked through a lot of hard issues and become closer and work through stuff. We're very tight today. But once you get, I have a lot more family. Most of my family members can't make it because they're far away. But the group here today is very dedicated, and we're very close, so I'm very appreciative of that.
So if you were paroled to, and that's not to say what the boys are going to do, but what would you do if you were taken off home arrest and put on regular parole? What would that mean to you?
Well, the first thing is what I wanted to do from the beginning, which was apply for a state transfer to Pennsylvania. When I first got out, there was a lack of information when I was incarcerated and stuff, and I had no idea. I didn't realize until I got out here, I found out the facts that I can't do it. So I just have been, just had to go with that. But that would be the first thing I would do is apply for, as soon as I can, apply for in-state transfer. Other things are just being off the income will just improve our possibilities. I mean, I got a guy waiting to hear the result of this hearing right now because my supervisor, who I could possibly get a good promotion if this goes well, because, it's just hard to be in any, to get a, be in any kind of supervisory position or any, to get a promotion. It's hard when you're under such time constraints. You can't ever stay if there's a problem, stay an extra hour or things like that. So, they don't really want to consider somebody that's that time things. And so, I'm looking forward to that, the possibility that they're going to put my name in for a promotion. And it opens up some possibilities like that. Also.
So, sir, in reading all the information, I'll tell you one thing that it just kind of puzzled me, and you may can explain this and you may not, but when the incident occurred that you went in, you locked the door, you shot the blinds, and immediately shot the postmaster, why did you do that without conversation? What? No threat or no force, or why would you do that and just not commit the robbery? Why would you take the life of the person?
It's very hard to look back now. I ask the same questions. Why? In my brain at the time, I kind of put myself in a weird mental corner where I felt like I didn't know what I was doing, first of all. I mean, we're committing armed robbery. And I was extremely nervous
Take your time. Do you want us to get you some water? Did you want some water, sir?
I had in my mind that that's how I would get away with it, I think, that's one of the thoughts going through my head at the time. But like I said, as soon as I did that, I knew that that was, it was totally illogical. I mean, if you look at all the facts together, I left the trail that was so obvious, so it makes no sense that I thought I was, could get away from by doing this. But I was very confused at the time. There was no need to do that. I mean, but through a lot of bad thinking and thinking it was a do or die situation in my mind, because I was like, I didn't have any outlets. I had no second plan. I had no body to, no outlet. I had no other. I thought it was either that I was going to die. That's what I felt at the time, that I was on, that edge of, that I had to make a decision, to do a decide decision. And,
so what, and I hear what you're saying, but what's changed about you that if you were put in a situation again where you were in financial straits, things were going bad, you didn't have the family support, what would prevent you from doing an act like that again, sir?
Oh, as I was saying earlier, I fundamentally changed right after that. It was like seeing the bomb go off. I saw it this is not the way human beings should act. And I'm not gonna act that way. That's why I've never had I have no violence in prison. That's a violent place. I have just always tried to, you know, be calm and I can never act that way again, no matter what the circumstance. It's just a fundamental change, you know, in who I am and what kind of decision I would make.
So in the report, it said that you found out that you didn't think the victim had died, but you found out later. How did you find out? When did you find out that the victim had actually died?
I heard it on the radio report.
Okay. So did you, what was the idea of going to Laguna Beach?
I was just fleeing. I really wasn't thinking. I was just getting away. And I went west because the whole time before that I was coming west. I came from Pennsylvania. I was trying to go west. And when I committed the crime, I just was running and I just ran west. Like I said, I just felt there was no return for me. It was a weird, like I said, I was in a weird tunnel vision of no return. I was just going a certain direction, and so I just continued to go west, and I didn't stop. I didn't rest, but I didn't stop until I hit the ocean, and I'm like, here's the ocean, and then the food, all that was coming from I was in like a state in that drive, just of like realizing what I did, and that's when it hit me right then, like I understood what I did. And that's when I told myself that.
So do you think that if you were on parole, you would continue counseling?
Sure, yeah.
How long do you think you would just continue the counseling? So is that just temporarily, or?
I don't know. So I feel it's maybe it was just not, totally not needed, have sort of my purpose,
This is my final question, and I'm going to see if the board has some additional questions for you, sir. Can you, at least to me, explain to me as one board member, why you feel as though you should be placed on regular parole instead of home arrest?
Well, I know it's your job to judge, you know, how a person is, you know, by their past, how they're going to act in the future. And I mean, I know really, so when I look at myself, you don't see me day to day. If you do, this would be an easy decision because, at every place I've worked and everything, I'm very well liked there. I get along with everybody and I live a very conscientious life. I'm trying to be a good citizen. I mean, even if I go into my laundry room and see mint on mint or something on the dryer or somebody's sock, I'll put up their sock, do a roll of mint. I mean, just little things like that. I'm just conscientious of everything I do all the time. And but my record is 28 and a half years of nothing, no criminal activity, no drug use, and that's a pattern, and that's the pattern that's going to continue. So I hope that shows a substantial probability that the future will hold the same. I know it will. That's who I am today. Nothing evil or criminal ever crosses my mind. It's not going to.
Let me see, sir, if the board has any additional questions for you. Mr. Canales.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Buckingham, going back to the incident, and as we state routinely, especially at this stage, of your rehabilitation cycle. We're not here to retry the case, but without making excuses, on the day of the crime, were you having some sort of mental breakdown or psychotic episode? Because it is a pretty extreme thing to do considering where you're at the time. So just to revisit that for a moment, I'm still trying to understand how you could have arrived at such an extreme crime.
Well, yes, I mean, the pre-sentence report described it exactly as that. They described it as a manic breakdown, because there was a lot of factors, and just, of course, simple factors of being fatigued physically, hungry, just a whole list of factors. You put them all together in a young 18-year-old who had a gun plan, and all these things build up. I push myself into such a corner, and I had very few things on the bike, and one of them was a weapon. And with that idea popped into my head, an extreme situation that has never happened before or since. Nothing of that. You know, it was a perfect storm of a mental breakdown.
My other question is, you've been on home arrest status for 2.5 years. I certainly commend you for staying on home arrest status for 2.5 years because it's restrictive. But were you having troubles initially during your first months of home arrest? Infractions? Any problems with your parole officer? The reason why I ask is because I'm looking at the most recent report. It seems pretty normal. Your attendance and programming is good, you have positive tests, you're not delinquent in any fees. So were you having transition issues initially?
No. I had, my first 6 months, I had two minor violations.
What were they for?
My ankle monitor was not fully charged. Both of them for only, one of them was for like 30 seconds, and the other one was for, I don't know, 50 minutes, but that was my only violation. No problems with the parole officer. I've only had five minor violations in 2.5 years. The other violations were just mistakes I made, getting the schedule and slipped out the door early or relaxed. Came back to the house a couple minutes late or once from the schedule, so I just missed the scheduled times. Those have been my only violations.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions?
Any other questions? So as you talk about your violation, there was one other violation where you had a job and you were terminated from the job, because we had this conversation before where you were terminated from the job and they made the allegation that when you left, you told the people you had been fired, you were angry, and you flipped them off.
That was no violation. No violation in that. That was that was wrongfully reported. We went over this for an entire hearing one time, and I presented a lot of evidence, and by the end, the board was just confused, because none of it made sense, and the board was like getting on the ADOC saying they should investigate this more because it doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And it doesn't, because a lot of it was false, what was written in there.
Okay.
You know.
Okay, sir. Seeing no other questions coming from the board, there's one other issue that I want to ask about, is that you went to the post office 3 to 4 separate times, from one time to purchased some paper, I believe it was. Went the next time to purchase an envelope. You went the next time and just waited for everybody to leave, and then you proceed to ride. You had 3 separate occasions at least to go back in and out of there. Did your mind change or anything during that period of time, or what?
I was basically scared. So I was building up my courage. I was making a decision. I was building on my courage, I think. You know, I was stuck in that thing where I had to do something, and I think I decided to do that, but I couldn't go through it. I had to keep pushing myself to go through it. why are some of the stubbornness that the town is missing?
Okay, so I am, the board has no additional questions. So I do want to acknowledge, and we talked a little bit about it, that you do have a parole plan, a parole packet that you included. It also has several letters of support that you have in here. It also talked about the positive things that you've been doing in your job, as well as going from home arrest or staying at sober living and moving from sober living to getting your own apartment, to getting your own car, which you stated that you've already stated that you did. It also talked about a little bit about a relationship that you had with a friend of yours who came from out of town. You guys stated, you know, that you've been living a regular and a normal life during that period of time. So I do want to acknowledge that if you do have had the opportunity to actually review it in the support letters that we actually have in there, okay?
Okay.
So if you want to go ahead and have a seat, I am going to call up some of your supporters now. Okay. And so I see that, and some of these names, because I can't read the, totally read the writing in here, I see that your father's here, you have an aunt, your mother, your uncle, and your stepmother are here.
My mother is going to speak first.
Okay, so if your mother's going to speak first, we have them come up in order. So all those that are here in support of Mr. Buckingham, what I would like you to do is just come in the order that you choose. Come up to the mics, please just state your full name and go ahead and present the information to the board, and then we'll see if we have any questions, and then we'll just go in that order with the supporters. After we have heard from the supporters, then I'm going to go to the victim witnesses, that the victim advocates that we have here, and then I'm going to end up with the parole officer, getting the report from the parole officer. I think the parole officer here, is that right? Yes, sir. But then I'll get the report from the parole officer. Okay? So the supporters, who's going to come up first, will just come up and state your name.
Good morning. My name is Beverly Dodd Satan, Brian's biological mother.
Okay.
I'm here today to ask that Brian be taken off home arrest and put on general parole. We would like to reunite again as a family, and it's hard when he's out here in other states. So I would appreciate that. And I just have a few things to say, and I'll kind of read them a little bit so other people will have time to speak. Brian has accomplished so much in his past almost 3 years, working two jobs that turned into one full-time job with benefits. He retrained himself to drive by going to driver's school, got his license, and bought him a car on his own. I am proud of how he has managed to live his minute-to-minute life in accordance with his weekly schedule. So many issues can occur during his time out, and how he has managed to still meet those times as perfect as any human being can do. I have gained great compassion for people in Brian's situation and what they must do to survive and excel in their reentry process. I have always heard that society wanted these folks to succeed in life after starting over, to become a success story. And I believe today in front of you, we have one of those success stories, and that is in Brian. He worked really hard to come this far. He's gone through a lot of it all by himself because we're in the house flat away. We can help him with phone calls and that sort of thing to be rough, but to be spot on, we can't do that right now. Brian has lived and reacted almost perfectly, which we all know is a very stressful task for anyone in everyday living. An extra for Brian with his minute-to-minute requirements according to his schedule, which in itself is a task, because the thought process that goes into that, to make sure that he pushed the right time, the right dates, and follow those. And he does that weekly, and then also he does that a week in advance. So to me, that would be quite a challenge. If Brian can live without that annual monitor and schedule, he would be able to deepen his relationships and improve his job opportunities also. Brian is working gratefully to move into the next step in his life. I am the deepest hope that the board will grant this and let us all start the new year and go from the past into the future, and let's see Brian succeed some more.
Okay, so the board have any questions? I had one question. That's something I wasn't clear on in the report. When this incident happened, it says he called his mom. Now, I wasn't sure if it was you or if it's stepmom. Yes. Was it you? Okay. And so what did you think when he called and he hung up on you when he was...
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't want him to take that trip.
Uh-huh.
But he was young, and he was confused. I didn't know to the depth of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he did call me, and he asked me, and I'm going to make this real clear, he asked me for his money, not my money. It was money that was, he saved from his little jobs that he had, his birthday cards, all this, graduation money, every little thing that he had, he saved it. Well, I was responsible for him, so I took the money and put it in the bank. Okay? It was his, not mine. I never spent a dime of it.
That's
all those years. I promise you, I did not. And then when I remarried, I didn't know the man that I remarried was a monster. Okay? And he had me so brainwashed that he talked me into giving him that money that was Brian's to put it in his name so that his dad couldn't take it from him. His dad never tried to take it from him. But I was stupid in a sense, too, and I can understand years ago your thoughts compared to the way they are now. No one would ever do that to me now. They wouldn't take nothing off of me for my son. That's just it. I'll fight to my death for him. Because he's proved to me that he's really trying to be a good citizen and make up for the past. So that's why the money was a problem, and I didn't have it to give him. And I was a coward and could not tell him that I didn't have it. I had it, but it wasn't in my name, and I couldn't get it. And go find out, which is a different story. But when that man divorced me, he had put all the money that I had worked for. I still work today, and took it all. He put it in the bank account where it's and or or. And I didn't have and, I had or, and he took every bit of it. I started from zero, but now I'm to the point that I still work and I'm going to work. Because whatever challenges Brian comes up with money-wise, if he needs it, I got his back.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Gosman. Thank you for that, too.
That's it all.
Who's that? And who's next going to come up?
I am Janet Buckingham. I'm Brian's stepmother. And there's a lot of things I want to say that you don't see and hear, you know, from reading it. And I wanted to talk about when he was 19. I'm not a psychologist, obviously, but a 19-year-old brain is not developed enough. I mean, that has to give you some kind of an idea why he did what he did. I mean, he's, you know, it's just not a mature brain. And his brain as a 47-year-old today is a completely different brain. I just wanted to say that. But I also wanted to focus on the impression that we had upon release from prison 2.5 years ago was to move Brian to Pennsylvania with interstate commerce. And that was his basic, you know, that was all he thought about. None of us thought he'd be spending this much time in Arizona. But despite that, Brian has accepted it all to move to our, you know, I mean, it took us a little while, but he accepted it right from the beginning. He said, this is what I got to do, this is what I got to do. And he has stuck right through to prove himself worthy of general parole and then the transfer. And that's what he's working for. He's totally focused on that. His determination is just, I mean, unbelievable. You can see that through what he's accomplished. The first thing he did apply to Carmel Vista because we heard this was a good place for him to go. But they weren't accepting offenders in his, such as him. So at the time of the request to live there, they said no, but we said, look, just look at his packet. And they did, and they thought for a while, they had a board meeting, and they decided, you know what, we're going to take a chance on this guy. And they accepted him into the home, and they were so impressed with his records and his accomplishments while in prison. When he left 9 months later, when he found another place to live, because he'd gone through all the steps, he accomplished everything that they required, the director declared him a model resident. I mean, he was a leader in the house. He was actually helping the newer guys in that house achieve what he had achieved, much to his embarrassment, I think. But he earned their full respect. And there's a letter in there on page 48 that says from them that he had earned their respect. And Brian's made so many friends through these jobs and the living arrangements, and he's continued these relationships over the past 2.5 years, and I'm sure he'll continue them once he's gone from here. But there's been some in Arizona who don't want him to succeed and have actively worked to get his friends and co-workers fired from their jobs as assistant manager, simply just for supporting them. People that have seen his potential and have sabotaged, you know, it just doesn't make sense. So half of his support letters in there are for his friends, not us family who would naturally write, but these are friends and co-workers that he's worked with in these past 2.5 years. We have family and friends at home that are more than willing to continue the process once he gets back to Pennsylvania. You know, I think it's in everyone's best interest to just go on and move out of Arizona. Grant him the general parole. He's grown so much with his life skills and today's challenges. And now it's 2.5 years later, and we just don't know what else there is left for him to accomplish to prove that he's worthy of this. And I really wish half of your parolees would be as display that kind of discipline. I wish I had that discipline in my life. I don't even have that discipline in my life. But I just wanted to thank you for the chance for him to prove himself by having him out on home arrest all this time, and that we've had him without the bars and the situations, and just hope that you conclude this 2.5 years has really changed him. He's going to continue the therapy, and who knows how long. I mean, you know, you get things happening in your life, and my gosh, we all see therapists, unfortunately. But I just want you to consider him a good success story and you know, pass him on to us to continue.
Yes. Thank you. Is there any questions, Ms. Blackman? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Is you can't undo things. What you do in life is what you do. It can't be undone. You can make your life better. You can go on. But what you've done, you divorced the mother of your child. You created a terrible place in this world for a young boy to try to grow up with. Later on, that teenager explained a love for music to me that, being the person I am, I didn't understand. The only thing I understood was get your diploma, get a job. And that was a destruction for some people that loves music. The boy loved music. He still loves music. He still works with computer. He has a couple of guitars, and he writes music, and he enjoys it. But I'm not the type of person that can turn to making a living on music. I mean, you got to get a job. You got to go through life and make things work well. This is not the thing that a teenage boy wants to hear. And like I said, from that, things can't be undone. And things happened. And fortunately, he has done a very good job of trying to undo the damage that I've done. Thank you.
All right, sir, let me see if the board has any questions. Sir, seeing the board has no question. Thank you, Mr. Buckingham.
Hi, I'm Patty DiGennaro. I'm Brian's aunt. And I just want to talk to you today about asking, obviously, for Brian to be moved to general parole. It may sound strange, but I'm very proud of Brian, and I tell him that all the time. A lot of people would be maybe surprised because somebody that has served 26 years for his crime, you know, it may seem hard to be proud of that, but it's not the crime, obviously, that I'm proud of, but the man that Brian's become. And I know that this is an isolated act, and Brian has given an explanation of that to the best of his ability. And I think it's important to realize his mindset at that time and the best that he's tried to explain that mindset and who he was at 19 years old, and he had just turned 19. excuse me. And he hasn't had any criminal violations, any criminal acts prior to or since that. He's obviously been under the strictest microscope during, you know, this 28 and a half years. But he's had no drug offenses ever, you know, no drug use, no dirty analysis at all, during prison, after, you know, and during his, no, I shouldn't say dirty urinalysis, no drug use at all. He's taken all the classes that have been provided by the DOC, but in addition, he's taking additional classes. He just has that thirst for knowledge. But people will tell you that he's a person of privilege, and I also want to dispel that myth as well. When you look at Brian's past, he's not a person of privilege at all. Brian has created his life for himself. He does have support, there's no question, and we have mended the family, this blended family that we've become. I am his aunt because my sister is his stepmother. So, you know, it's my choice to be involved in Brian's life. I'm not his biological aunt, and my husband is here. It's his choice to be involved. And so we're really, you know, I say I'm his Aunt Patty, but really I'm his friend. And my friends are also his friends. So, you know, Brian's that kind of person. It's not, we don't have to stay involved. I don't have to send him birthday cards and stay involved in his life. It's my choice. And it's his choice to stay involved with me. So I think that's important for you to remember. It's not, we're not here because out of that obligation. And choice, I think, is an important word to use there. And here is a person that has made the choice to control his reactions during the most difficult of situations, and that includes that 26 years of prison. I can't even begin to imagine what that would be like. And then that release into the unknown, and I was involved with his release and riding the bus with him, trying to figure out the bus schedule in Phoenix, which, good God, I can't even relate what that was like. He's released into a foreign city, and there were some little pressures with that, and he made the choice not to react in any criminal fashion. He has made lasting friends. He's become a valued employee. He's mastered the bus and rail systems, and thanks to the board, he has been able to learn to drive. And it goes on with everyone else. The parole packet says it. Everybody else has reflected that. I won't go over it again. And does he have emotions? Absolutely. Does he act in a way that does not violate the law in any fashion? Yes. He has not violated the law. And he's made that choice every minute of every day. And it's not because he's on home arrest. He's made that choice when he turned himself in. He made that choice back then, and that was his initial and only crime that he's ever committed. And it was when that realization struck him. And nothing's going to change that past, and nothing will ever let Brian forget that. That's part of who he is. But he has remained focused on the future. And I ask your, I guess, I apologize in advance. I'm not an attorney, and I don't play one on TV, but I'm going to recite something from the Arizona Revised Statutes. At the very beginning, when we requested, we came to the board, I'm not sure who had recited this, but part of the statute is 31-412. It says, if a prisoner certified as eligible for parole pursuant to section 4116.04.09, the Board of Executive Clemency shall authorize the release of the applicant on parole if the applicant has reached the applicant's earliest parole eligibility date pursuant to the same section. Subsection D, and it appears to the board in its sole discretion that there is a substantial probability that the applicant will remain at liberty without violating the law and that the release is in the best interests of the state. So I'm focusing on that there is a substantial probability that the applicant will remain at liberty without violating the law and that the release is in the best interests of the state. So I think it's the 2.5 years has shown that it is in the best interests of the state and in the best interests of the families. As I said, nothing can change the past. Brian is focused on the future. We're all focused on the future and how we can move forward. And that's the only thing Brian can offer. So I think to best serve the statute is to release Brian to general parole so that he can return to Pennsylvania. And I think that's the only thing that's going to really move us off of where we are right now. I mean, he has not acted criminally. He's had no criminal actions at all. I think the only thing at this point is he has a problem with being late, so you know that has been proven in he's gotten over that by posting his schedules, and I'm impressed with that. He posts the schedule on the back of his door, so when he walks out of the apartment, he can now see that schedule, and then he crosses off so that he's trying to find solutions so that he can make corrections every time that he runs into a problem. And I think that just makes me more prouder. Every time he runs into a situation, he counteracts that situation. So again, I ask you to move him to general parole. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Steve and Janelle? Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else to speak in support? I noticed Ms. Janelle was kind of correct to everyone. So are you the last one to speak in support?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to go to victims. And do we have someone from the victim advocates that's going to come up and help with that?
My name is Donna Grigg. I'm married to Fred Grigg, who was Jackie Grigg's husband. I had planned to speak today in prepared remarks. However, it was always in the back of my mind, and I'm convinced of that now. I've come to the realization this morning that nothing I say or do is going to change this. This family got bad legal advice when this happened, or they would have tried to fight even the offer of a plea agreement and or the sentence so that parole would never have been an option. It is excruciating for this family to have to go through this every 6 months or so. To sit here and listen to this man go on and on about his nice apartment, driving lessons, retirement account, socks and lint in the dryer, and how hard his life is laughable. I wish my husband could pour his heart out to you today, but he suffers from aphasia as a result of the stroke he had 2.5 years ago, right before one of these hearings. So I am deferring to my girls. Suffice it to say, our family will continue to fight this as long as we drop her up. Thank you.
Any questions?
My name is Wanda Easter. I'm the middle child of the victim, Jackie Grigg. I would like to ask that you consider what I have to say today, as I feel that when we come here, the board allows us to speak, but doesn't truly listen. Doesn't focus on what we have to say, as we nor our mother are the concern. I think this has been one of the hardest things for me to face. This is not about my mother. It's not about how we killed her. It's not about how she died, how we premeditated it. No, today is about Brian Buckingham. He has become the victim. I feel that these proceedings have one goal, and that goal is not justice or the good of society. It is about helping Brian Buckingham and giving him a chance. Another chance. Some people don't get more chances. I don't have another chance to see her. She doesn't have a chance to see her family. But the criminals, they want another chance. As Brian says, let him be the example of what a murderer can be in society. He'll be the example to the world if the clemency board sets him free. Therefore, with that in mind, I would ask that you take into account the following when you make your decision today. We've listened to this countless times now, it feels like. The story changes. I sit and make notes about how, when questioned, the story has changed. He stopped because he ran out of money. He stole her car and $40. That's as far as he could go. His mother didn't give him any money, right? He took $40 out of a post office, a rural post office. Brian Buckingham has been out on the ankle bracelet for close to 2.5 years and states that he has had no issues and been a model citizen. Really? What about letting the ankle bracelet go dead more than once? What about screaming at one of his employers, riding off, flipping her off on his bicycle? What about lying to an employer about what he was a felon for? Failure to disclose. How many jobs has he had? He has only had his last job for approximately 6 months. That is not long term in our society. I've been at my job since 1995. I believe he's been terminated more than once from employment for his inability to follow direction, his failure to tell the truth, and then has responded with anger and hostility. I do not believe that Brian Buckingham shows remorse, nor does he take responsibility for his actions. He did not when he murdered my mother, and he still does not today. He has now been trained and coached to come here and say and behave differently each time. I do not believe that he possesses the feelings that a normal mentally stable person does. It is quite the person that the system has to send to a class to teach them how to have basic morals and feelings. I have heard board members ask him if when he realized what he had done, when he shot her and stepped over her while she was dying to steal her meager belongings, did he get outside and think, oh, what have I done? Did he go out that back door and throw out the lady on this board? Ask him that. The answer was no. When Brian closes his eyes at night, does he see her dying body? We don't hear of that. I can still picture what she looked like when we identified her in the emergency room of the hospital. And I will never, ever quit seeing what she looked like, laying in the casket. I believe that he still blames the world for everything that happens to him. To this day, whether it be why he murdered her or why he lost his most current job, it is always someone else's fault. And he is put upon, for example, he has to take the bus and only had a track phone. Really? How many good people every day take public transportation? I saw employees get off the bus out front here this morning. They're making it work. It's a travesty, though, for Mr. Buckingham to have to use the bus. If he cannot take responsibility, how can he change his behavior? In addition, if he does not change his behavior, why is he released into society? He still has no answer when asked why he killed her. None. So can it be inferred that if he does not know why, he will not be able to prevent himself from acting the same way again? That day, he borrowed from her. He didn't go in and buy paper. He didn't buy a pen, and he didn't buy an envelope. My mama gave it to him because he was a young man and asked her for help. There were people there that saw it. He said he wanted to write his mother a letter. My mother, being a kind woman, lent him those items. He cold-bloodedly planned and carried out the murder of a woman who was a non-threat. I have heard the board ask if she provoked him. No, to the contrary, she was kind to him. Incidentally, my mother was a woman of about my size, not much of a threat to a 19-year-old man. In my opinion, people such as this board and our justice system can fail the whole country by letting people that don't belong in society out. We hear it every day. Last week, a 21-year-old man killed his parents, his girlfriend, and her parents because something did not go his way. Two teenage girls shot their mom because she took away their cell phones. Society will not want punishment so that others don't follow suit. Society wants to fix the offenders. It's not working. It is an honorable quality to want to help people, but I believe that those you are trying to help should deserve it and not be a threat to society. At the time of murder, it was said that Brian had severe personality disorder. How does that go away? Court documents show his mother feared for her life. Those are not my words. I have them in black and white. I believe that Brian Buckingham is not only a drain on society, but he's a danger, and that the harder his life on the outside becomes, the more dangerous he will become. All day, we've heard of nothing except getting this transfer, this interstate transfer. What if that doesn't go through? Am I in danger? Are my family in danger? We have the courage to come and stand here and oppose this every time. Now he's got a car, driver's license, money. What if he doesn't get the transfer? Who do you think he's going to come for? I know that people want to fix those that are broken and help them and help society be a better place. But doing that could harm someone else. There could be another family that has suffered for 28 years. There could be another woman that will never see her grandchildren. They didn't want your kids graduate from high school or college. Please, I implore you, he has not changed. Please keep Brian Buckingham on home arrest. Thank you.
I have one question.
Yes, sir.
So I understand the emotional feelings on this, but do you feel that no criminal can ever be rehabilitated? I mean, you made some statements, so I'm just trying to see if that's your
opinion. No, sir, I don't believe that.
Okay.
But I believe that this man, I've stood him, sat back there. His voice has never cracked back when he was on the phone, never shed a tear, never was ill. So, no, I don't believe that all people are inherently evil if they commit a crime. This was a premeditated, thought-out crime, and he still can't explain it today. There are good people that make bad decisions, maybe in a heated argument, a fight, under the influence of a drug or a narcotic. None of that happened.
Okay. The board have any additional questions? Mr. Kenyatta.
Just one more. Profound respect. And certainly not to be defensive. I wonder in recollection and what happened. I think it's regretful, but did someone from this board ask if your mother had been provoked?
Yes.
This board?
Not this particular board. We've sat through different boards, so I apologize. I mean the clemency board in general, not you four individuals sitting up here. It was a prior board. I can't remember the
gentleman. I'm not here to broadcast any prior board members. I found that a little disturbing.
He was a detective. He sat right in that seat. And he said, did she provoke you? The answer was no. And his response at the end was, he committed the most heinous crime possible to a non-threat. I think that's the direction his questioning was going, whether or not there was an argument or a frustrating situation or something like that.
Thank you for putting that in context. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Mr. Neal.
I would like to say one thing. Some of your comments going in this hit home pretty deep with me. My three-year-old grandson was murdered, and I've gone through what you're going through. And I say that because the voice change, this is not that I have released him to home arrest. And with that, we are restricted in certain ways the way we can handle it. But I want to assure you that, and myself for sure, and I'm pretty certain on my three fellow board members at this time, we do take into consideration the victims and, you know, in that side of it. It's not just one-sided. But I can understand also your frustration when you do come in front of different boards and you get different reactions to everything going on. And I can understand a feeling of a deep-seated feeling of bitterness. And that's not, you know, I'm not chastising you in any way or shape or form. But we do at least, you know, part of them do fully understand what you're going through. So,
I appreciate that. I'm sorry for your situation.
Okay. Thank you, Missy.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Sean Weiss.
stand here today, as I've done many times before. Every time my family and I are here for Brian Buckingham's parole hearing, we relive that fateful, horrific day that he took my mother's life. We have listened to the gory, unimaginable details. The first time that we came and went through this, he was actually still in prison, and he was on the monitor. And the board would ask him so many questions and describe what happened. I never knew all the details. I was 16 when this happened. And I could not get it out of my mind. Still to this day, I can't. Every time I have to come here and stand up for what is right for my mother, I relive this. And I know that everyone wants to help this victim. Him not being the victim, because my mom's not here anymore. She's no longer the victim. We need to fix this so-called man, the victim. Has anyone ever offered to fix us? Me, my sisters. I was 19 years old when I had my daughter. Actually, she was born the day before my 19th birthday. And you know what? My brain was fried. I raised my daughter. She's now 26 years old. She's a respectful, intelligent woman. I lived through some very difficult times. Knowing I didn't have my mother to go to at 19 when I had my daughter. It was gone. All that was gone. And because of what? Because he made a choice, a conscious choice to do what he did. Because he was angry. And that was also disclosed in the first hearing. He was angry with his mother because she wouldn't send him money. But it's amazing now. Now he's a changed person, and she's going to do whatever she can. Any belonging she has, anything she has, her life, everything she'll give for him. But she didn't do it then. I gave everything I had to my daughter. I worked two jobs. I was a single mother by the time she was 1 year old. I divorced my husband because he was abusive. And I raised her. I had felt help from my family, of course, but you know what? She turned out just fine. I want you all to listen and hopefully understand where I'm coming from. This man, he's now out in society. He has to wear an ankle monitor to hopefully protect us if he does have one of these outbursts again and decides to harm someone else. But we don't know. I take my family out. I come to Phoenix. I can take my daughter and my granddaughter to the aquarium. Maybe we go eat at IHOP. Gee, we didn't know a killer was working in here. What's to say that's not going to happen while he's in one of these places? That he's not going to have one of these outbursts for no reason. He doesn't know why he did it.
So let me just stop you for 1 minute, because I want you to address the board and not...
I'm sorry, sir.
Okay. I understand. I just... Okay, go ahead and finish, though.
You can't imagine how hard it is to sit there and listen to him speak. They kill my mother. And give all these excuses and not be able to stand up and say anything. Maybe you understand because you went through a tragedy in your life. It's unimaginable. It tears at my heart so hard. Do you want to know that after this happened, I didn't want to live anymore? I lost my mother. She was my best friend. She took care of me. I was very shy, not outgoing. She was always there for me. And now she's gone. I don't have that anymore. But we have to fix him. No. He has to pay for what he did. But he hasn't. still alive, and you still have a chance. She doesn't have a second chance. There's no second chance. He stepped over her while she was laying there dying. Can any of you imagine what she was thinking? What was in her mind? Am I going to survive? Am I going to ever see my family again? At 16, the day that that happened, I kissed my mom goodbye and said, I'll see you tonight when I get off of work. I worked for my brother-in-law that was an electrician. All day. It was a hot day. It was August 15th. It was hot in Arizona. I had the chills all morning. I couldn't understand why. Something wasn't right. I knew in my heart something wasn't right, but I didn't know what. But all the while, this person was stalking my mother, waiting to kill her for $40 because he was mad. There's no reason that this person should be granted anything. He would be lucky to serve his life in prison, in my opinion, and not get the death penalty. Life is about choices. And we all have to live with the choices that we make. He should have to live with the choice he made. I'm sure he doesn't think about his mom every day that's not here anymore. Oh yeah, because he still has his mom. Something has got to be done in the society to protect the good people. The people that go to work every day, that try hard, that take care of their families, that teach their children wrong from right, that give them morals. Why are we helping the bad people? That's all we focus on, is reforming bad people and making them better. Somebody needs to think about helping us. Somebody needs to think about helping my daughter and my granddaughter be safe in this crazy world. I just really pray with all my heart that the decision we make today, that you can live with that decision in the event that this happens again. Because it's on the far of your shoulders. You're going to think about it when he gets out and something does happen again, which I have faith that it will. You're the one that have to live with that. It's not his family anymore. They obviously don't care what he did. But you do, or you wouldn't be here. So I pray that you make the right decision. And I'll make one last statement. In the Bible, it said, an eye for an eye. And I do believe with my whole heart, if this person doesn't pay for his crime here on earth, God will ensure that one day he does pay for his crime. Thank you.
What have any questions?
Jackie Griggs' oldest daughter, Renee Griggs. Last night I was sitting in my hotel room and I was going to sit down and write a letter for you guys so I could sit here today and read that. And the words escape me sitting trying to write a letter because, as everyone says, we're not here again today to retry for Ann Buckingham. We failed epically at that. 28 years ago with the plea bargain. We were a devastated family, and uneducated in a murder, and unknowingly agreed to something that brought us here today. Brought us to a place to sit and listen to a man who, as my first sister, Wanda, said, the little sister brought to your attention that on numerous occasions, we've heard so many different stories. But I have to say the best question I've ever heard from a board member was today when Mr. Johnson asked him why he didn't give our mother an opportunity to speak. Because I'd like to share with you that we live about 30 miles from the Hualapai Nation. And I know it's not a pretty picture, but the intoxicated natives would sit down by our fence and my mother would pack sandwiches to them. So hungry, scared, that what's in Brian Buckingham, when he borrowed a post envelope, a piece of paper to write his mom and all the things, every excuse he gave, he could have given the excuse that he was hungry and tired and thirsty, and she would have fed him, given him water, soda pop, whatever he needed to help him out that day. So I appreciate Mr. Johnson's question because it brought to my mind, again, the kind of person that my mother was. And although we're not here to retry Mr. Buckingham today, we are here to ensure that the security of the public is met and that the facts are brought forward. And the facts are, as I said and read the clemency packet from Mr. Buckingham, it was all about him and his recent successes. There was nothing about the facts of his past discretions, nothing about why he made those mistakes, nothing about how he was changing his life because of the mistakes, just about, if you will, yay me. As I read this letter, I see Ms. Rittenhouse seems to smile a lot and be appreciative of his goals and achievements. I'm a human resources director for a fourth largest fast food franchisee in the United States. I go through a lot of background checks. And as Mr. Buckingham's aunt clearly stated, two of his friends lost their job because of some unworthy person reporting it. You know, I wasn't the unworthy person that reported Mr. Buckingham was a first-degree murderer to IHOP. That was Mr. Buckingham's job to do that. I did it for him, but that was his responsibility under his conditions of parole to do that. It wasn't my job, but I took care of it for him. Once again, the chameleon, Mr. Buckingham, using other people to obtain his wants and needs. Facts. Not a retrial, but facts that each of you are presented with today. Also called a couple of his other employers and assisted him in his occupation. Once again, facts, non-disclosure of his current situation. Mr. Buckingham, the chameleon, as my sister said, who's been very well scripted to come to these plays, if you will, and put on an outstanding performance for everyone until he gets what he needs and wants, goes out and fails ethically again, walks into the next place, finds a victim, and again doesn't ask the questions, as Mr. Johnson pointed out. I'm not here to retry him today. I'm here to present the facts and ask that you utilize those facts to make a collaborative decision for the well-being of the public and my family. The governor set you all here today to to listen to, not to betray, but to listen to the facts. And also, I understand, as his aunt spoke up here of case of different statutes, there's case law. And in the case law, there should be remorse for the victims. There has been not one mention in anything I read of remorse, just how Mr. Buckingham saw the error of his ways and changed for the better. Not that he's sorry, but that he had seen the error of his ways. I know that you all have had trials in life. We all have trials in life. Life is a trial. But having 8,000 employees, I can guarantee you, I get many of them that call me with three times people are late to work. Every time, I'm like, no, we have to write them up. We have to give them opportunities. Do you know how many people I practice in some employment law in seven states? I'm HR in seven states. And I can assure you that those 8,000 employees in seven states, at least 50% of them who haven't killed or committed heinous crimes, use public transportation to get to work. We are a young franchisee, Taco Bell, KFC, Long John Silver's. Last night, I attended a Boys and Girls function, Boys and Girls Club. Last year, our franchise alone, we contributed over $500,000 to the youth in this valley. Last night, I sat there and watched young people. We filled backpacks with school supplies. We are good people. There is help for people like Mr. Buckingham. They have to want it. They have to ask the questions. This isn't a retrial. This isn't a do-over. This is a man who shows no remorse and is a chameleon, and I please beg of you, as you watch my family here today, my dad, as my stepmother said, he would like to pour his soul out to you, not to retry him, but to take into consideration that if we didn't have the honorable people that serve on the parole to watch him, that we'd be right back where we started from already, because he has used people since the day he got out, and I've been following his back door every time I get the chance. And I've caught him. I appreciate your time today, and I happily answer any questions you'd like to answer in the last few.
I don't have any questions. I do want to make a comment, though, in reference to the comment by Ms. Rittenhouse. I think that sitting up here on this board is one of the most difficult things. I mean, we do sympathize with the family. We sympathize with the victims, but it is a very difficult task to sit up here and listen to the stories on both sides and then have to make that decision. So certainly, you know, I would just ask that not to judge board members, whether they smile or they don't smile, because it's difficult. There's times when things happen that, you know, you want to cry, but you have to hold those tears in. There's things that's happened that you want to just smile just to try to do that. But I do want to say that, because you did make the comment about Ms. Rittenhouse and smiling. But I just want to just put that out there, that it's a very, very difficult decision sitting up here, and to have to hear and listen to not only the defendant's family and listen to the victim's family, but hear all of those. And that, you know, the one thing that you said is very true, is that we have to listen to the facts. And, right, and those can be disturbing at times. So I would just ask you to not take in consideration whether one smiles or one doesn't smile, or what their reaction is going to be, because of the difficulties that we have here with making that decision. So,
I appreciate that coaching, and I will take that into consideration.
Are there any more victims? You're the oldest daughter, so is anyone else going to speak? Or kind
of? No, I believe I
am. Okay.
Follow up the pack. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. At this time, I'm going to hear from the parole officer.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Go ahead and state your full name and just, as the parole officer, give us some information. We do have your progress report that we have here on file, sir.
My name is Jaime Herrera. I've been a parole officer with the state of Arizona for a year and 2 months. I've been with the Department of Corrections for 4 years and 3 months. I'm just going to give a quick synopsis, just a declaration of facts of my supervision with Brian Buckingham. I started supervision with Brian Buckingham on November 1st of 2018. Since then, he has been subject to weekly contacts. These contacts have been formal, but generally they've been unannounced and they've been staggered. Being a parole officer and supervising someone on home arrest, I try to keep my contacts unannounced, staggered, and unpredictable. Being that I'm making sure that Mr. Buckingham is in compliance with his conditions of supervision. He is subject to random urinalysis testing, which all the reports come back negative. All correspondence, text messages, and phone communication with Mr. Buckingham, he's always responded quickly. He's always responded in a timely manner. There's been no delays. When I approached his home unannounced, a knock and notice, there's been no unnecessary time delay that can lead me to believe that he's deviating from his condition of supervision. So very seldom he'll come into the office for a formal contact, which will go over employment, residence, we'll go over his cost of supervision, we'll go over his GPS schedule. Some contacts are made in which I come unannounced and I'll do a full inspection. That will include going through his cell phone. That will include doing a cursory search of his house to look for any contraband or any type of items or behavior that can lead me to believe that he's violating his conditions of supervision. Inasmuch, Mr. Buckingham submits every Thursday an email of his itinerary. On his itinerary, we review together what he's going to be doing for the week that's going to be coming up, his work, employment, and leisure activities, which include going to the store, attending a counseling, or attending going out to maybe a restaurant for an hour or so. I often do audit checks on this GPS system to make sure that he is not deviated from his GPS device. I found no discrepancies as far as any deviation. There was one only, the past violation was due to when he was purchasing a vehicle. Back in October, I was not his parole officer. The purchase of the vehicle did extend past 9 p.m. his curfew, in which he made notifications. Technically, that is a violation of his parole. He addressed it, he made notifications, and it was a violation for 30 minutes because it was the first time for purchasing a vehicle, and the dealer kept him past his curfew time. He was addressed, he was brought in, he was staffed. Since then, November 1st, there's been no violations on his GPS that's come about. I just wanted to state facts. If you have any questions, you can feel free to ask me.
Does the board have any questions? Mr. Canales.
Just a quick one. As we've heard from testimony today, there was information presented that Mr. Buckingham did not notify employers of his criminal history. Is that anything that came to your attention as a parole officer? Thank you, sir.
Negative, because on November 1st, when I started supervision of Mr. Buckingham, he's already been employed with Fiesta Plastics. So anything before the supervision started, I have never seen any type of discrepancy of disclosing to his employer.
I won't move too straight to hypotheticals, but if one of your cases fails to notify, is that an issue for you as a parole officer? Just for clarity.
Yes. If the offender or a home arrest inmate does not disclose properly, they have a right to apply, they have a right to prospect and for an employer, but until there's verification made by the parole officer, they're not allowed to accept a job offer. And that verification will include the offender or house arrest inmate disclosing all the information as far as the criminal history.
Thank you, sir.
Just one more follow-up on that. So, when an offender tells you that they have a job, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that the parole officer contacts that employer and let them know.
On this case, that the fact that he's on GPS monitoring and the fact that the unit I work for, we deal with mainly high-risk sex offenders or home arrests, there has to be verification made before and they can accept an offer.
Okay. Any more questions? Thank you, sir. And Mr. Buckingham, we're coming up on the conclusion of your hearing, so we're going to be going in discussing very shortly. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the board, sir, prior to the board going into discussion?
Yes, sir. Would you comment, please?
Yes, sir.
I appreciate it. It's a tough decision. I really wish I could change. I wish, the perfect world and I could undo things and I could fix everything and heal everybody. But unfortunately, I don't have that power. All I can do is do what I can do now. It's the best I can do day to day. I can't ask for forgiveness, and I look at this one more 7 days. There's never been a doubt about that. You can look in the first, in my confession, all the reports from the beginning that have stated many times about how emotional I was. I had a total breakdown I could barely get off the confession. I was so emotional and broke down over everything. And that has led me to make decisions since then. That's why all my decisions since then have been good. Some people believe there's good and bad people, but I think there's good and bad decisions. There's a lot of people going into bad circumstances and they end up making bad decisions and for millions of different reasons. But I believe that, everybody can change. Everybody can be better. That's definitely what I try to do. I never blame anybody for my actions. I don't play the victim. I just try to state what I accomplished, which a lot of times is small, because I'm under such constraints at certain times that some of my, getting a car is nothing for my condition, but that took a lot of work under my condition. So, I've never complained about riding the bus or not. I did it for 2 years. I would only talk about it in the fact that it's just something, you have to. I was thrown out and didn't even know how to ride a bus. So it's, to me, I'm proud of the accomplishment of doing things, dealing with it, and moving forward. And I don't ever feel that something beneath me or that I'm something else that too hardship for me. I'm just trying to do, take responsibility and recover. That's why I've made the decisions I've made for the last 28 and a half years. I've never made the decision I can't deal with it, and I'm just going to do drugs to escape my mind. I've never done things like that. I don't want to. I'm trying to not escape reality, to be a better person, to do things, help other people. And I'm sure, some people, some people, no matter what I can do, some people, it's my past is always there. Some people will never, if I start a business tomorrow, make $1 million, give it to kids, stop an at-risk youth, who knows what I could do in the future. But, maybe some people, nothing I could do to ever make up for that. I can understand that. But, I'm going to do the best I can to do those things. I'm just doing the best I can as a person. I totally abide by the law, and I'm hoping for the best. I hope for the future, and I hope to improve. I don't complain about my situation now. I'm just hoping to move on and hoping for better things. And, for anyone, I don't like being a burden. I don't like putting a board through this and everything. That's all my my fault. You know, my actions initiated all this continuation. And, playing a victim or anything, just stating the facts of, as has been admitted here today, that, you know, I had active sabotage against him. You know, I've probably never come out and said, with all this stuff in my report, is the reason it was lied about that I was fired from the job is because people were acting to get me fired. And none of the facts in there about me, my job performance, was true. You know, they wanted rid of me, and they made up reasons. And, you know, and the reason a general manager was fired from a 10-year career at IHOP for simply writing this report letter. And these are the things that have followed me. You know, now that there was a slight incident recently, very recently, all those things happened a couple of years ago. Recently, there was an incident with my last parole officer where it wasn't that I was lying about anything, but some employers, when trying to get jobs, they will not let you talk because they have a department that does background checks and everything. So I have to, like, force information on them. And one time, I didn't get all the facts, and as the poor officer was asking me about that, I said, you know what, I forgot, I think I didn't say that. And then he jumps on me, oh, you're accusing me of doing it on purpose. Like, no way, I just admitted it, I forgot. I don't think that came out exactly stated the way I wanted. But the fact is the parole officer just told you, I cannot even accept a job. I can't show up at a job until the parole officer calls and everything is verified. So, but I have informed all my employers. And my employer, I have a job hop, they're not, all my employers, I have friends from all the jobs that I have. And the reason I do this job is because I moved way out in the river. I didn't know I was going to be on the west of Phoenix. I didn't know anything about this area. And the halfway house was in the building. I had no transportation. I got a job as closest to the halfway house that I could, a half mile away. That was my first job. Had it for over 9 months, anybody there loved me. The only reason I left that job was they gave me a raise and everything. And then I had to move out of the halfway house to the 90-day program. I spent 9 months there. It was way overdue for me to leave. You know, I just had trouble finding housing. I finally found housing in the Hilton Chandler. It took me 6 miles away from IHOP, and on a bicycle, that's a long trip. It's like 4 mile ride back and forth to work every day. So I started looking for a job closer, and I found one. It was 3 minutes walking away. It's right across the street. All right? And then I moved up here to Mesa. The reason I have the job now is because it's a 10 minutes away walk. I can walk there in 10 minutes. And then recently I have a car, so there's issue on issue. But I've only moved jobs to get closer to my housing, because I don't want to spend an hour on the bus, and sometimes, depending on when you're coming home from work, I've worked a lot of late shift, the bus is not even running. You know, so that's why, and all those jobs, not only have I mostly moved to be closer to housing, but also I've improved with all those jobs. I'm at my highest paying job right now. Every job that I've had has actually increased pay. Not by much, not a lot, but the job I have now is the highest paying job of all. Just to close, you know, I don't blame anybody. I've taken responsibility, and I've acted as such. I think the record shows of all these years that I've acted as such. I've made good decisions. Yes, I made a terrible decision in 1990. And since then, I've done my best, as little as it is at times, to be a better person, do what I can, to help others, and just do good, do what I can. That's what I've been trying to do, and I hope the board sees that side of me.
Thank you, sir. So, Mr. Buckingham, the board's going to go into discussion. While the board's in discussion, we will make a determination whether to grant or deny your parole to regular parole or absolute discharge or home arrest or continue on home arrest. So the board is now going into discussion on that. I think that the board has heard some compelling information coming from both sides in this particular the incident. I think that, taken into consideration, Mr. Buckingham does have a good release plan. He has done some great things since he's been out. I think we've had the opportunity to see many people come before this board to realize that there's some difficulties with being on home arrest and being able to maintain the restrictions. But home arrest is still like being incarcerated. You're still an inmate and have to abide by all the rules and regulations that we've had. We've had some compelling information given to us by Mr. Buckingham's family, from his mother, Ms. Scosby, and his stepmother, Ms. Buckingham, as well as Mr. Buckingham's father, and as well as his aunt, Ms. DeGennaro, that talked about, you know, the family history and what's going on. And I think it was his aunt, Ms. DeGennaro, I may not be pronouncing that right, but who came out here and actually rode the bus with him, worked with him to try to get him through to where he's at now, to be able to do some of the things that he's done. We've heard from the PO to talk about what he's done since he's been under his care and custody. And we also had the opportunity to talk and listen to Mr. Buckingham. We've heard from the victim's family. We've heard from Ms. Griggs, who is the wife of the father of Mr. Grigg, and her opinion that her husband, Mr. Grigg, had a stroke shortly after one of these hearings and the impact that it's actually had on him. We've heard from the victim's daughter, Wanda Esther, who, you know, was able to speak of the impact that it's actually had on her family, and from the other daughter, Sean Weiss, who talked about the impact that it had on their family, her being, I believe it was 16 years old when her mother passed, and I think she was 19 when she had her first child, to talk about that impact that it's had on her and her daughter and her family when she had two. And we heard from Ms. Renee Grigg, the oldest daughter of Ms. Grigg, and talked about the family and these things that we've gone through. And we have to make a decision based on all the information. I would tell you that 2.5 years is a long time that, you know, we've seen someone to actually be on home arrest before going to regular parole. I think that Mr. Buckingham has really done some good things on there. I'm a little bit torn on this issue. However, I do have some problems with this situation because of the way that the actual murder itself occurred, and the things that had. And I'm not just quite sure when I talked to Mr. Buckingham and asked him what would prevent him from doing, you know, this type of activity again, or if something happened. I did look at all the psychological reports that were in there. It basically said that he was pretty much aware of what he was doing at the time, and pretty much aware that it was a crime. I do think that Mr. Buckingham has quite a bit of remorse for what has happened, although I don't think he's able to really elaborate on his remorse. But the mere fact that after it happened, he did take the victim's vehicle and go to California, but he went into the police station and turned himself in. It kind of sounds like at first they didn't really believe him, and he turned himself into the police station. That had he not had any remorse for it, I don't think he would have ever turned himself in. He would have just kept going. However, I'm just at this point in time, I'm just not sure. Although he's been on home arrest for 2.5 years, this is an incident that happened when he was 19 years old. He's now 47 years old. There's a lot of time that has happened in between that time, those two time periods. However, I'm just bothered by the way that this incident happened, that there was no provocation on the witness. There was not a necessity to shoot the victim. And according to the report, it just says that, you know, without any provocation, he just shot the victim. And I would like to be a little bit more comfortable. Although I don't think that, you know, a person is not able to recover from behavior that occurred when they were a juvenile child, as he was when he was 19 years old. And I do think that we take into consideration, this boy takes into consideration, the victims as well as the defendant in each of these situations. We make decisions based on those facts and determination. However, at this time, I'm just not satisfied with the explanation that if he was in a situation where, in which I hope he would never be in that type of situation again, where he is just backed into a corner where he has nowhere else to go, he has no money, and he feels as though he's not getting any support, with what his reaction would actually be in that particular type of situation. So at this particular point in time, I'm just not totally comfortable with placing Mr. Buckingham on regular parole. I'd like to see the continued home arrest. I'd like to see the continued monitoring. I'd like to see him have the opportunity to work on his job for a longer period of time to see what the reaction is. I do understand that he's changed jobs, but, you know, as he stated, you know, all of us have changed jobs for the betterment, whether it's for salary, for a better job, a closer location. That's a common thing that's done. That's, in my opinion, how I'm willing to listen to the rest of my colleagues at this time. Mr. Quinones.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I just wanted to add for the dialogue. This board is an entity, and as long as I am a member of the board, I am part of an unbroken lineage. I recognize it is bad form to undermine any past decision by this independent board. So when confronted with a challenging case, the board has already granted home arrest to Mr. Buckingham, and it is not probable that he will stand home arrest forever. I say probable, not possible, but probable. Nonetheless, I did not hear much in the way of specific remorse regarding the murder, probably the murder of an innocent, decent human being. And I think it's much more than a terrible decision. I'm not sure if he is ready to graduate to greater privileges under supervised release. And I will just continue from there. Thank you.
Mr. Newell.
One of the things that strikes me about this, and it's not just this case, but a lot of them now, he or she was only 18, or he or she was only 19, and so their brain's not developed right, or completely, or whatever. But in this particular country, we send our men and women off to fight wars at 18 years of age. And they have to make life and death decisions all the time, and the vast majority of those people at 18, 19, 20 years old don't inadvertently kill innocent people. And by the same token, Mr. Buckingham is 47 years old now and much more mature, but we hear cases all the time where the crime occurred when the suspect or the offender was 65 years old when they got back at their neighbor and took a gun and shot him three times. So, in my opinion, age, unless you're getting down into 9, 10, 11 years old, I just can't buy into age as a defense. Also, I noticed that as Mr. Buckingham was talking to us about that, he apologized to the board for making us listen to this case every 6 months. He didn't say one thing about the victims having to do the same thing. It was about it when the victims gave notification of the board, it dragged up a lot of emotion with them than any hearing with the board members. And then I go to the idea of disclosure and some of those things like that. I do remember some of the things from the past hearing, and I'm just not comfortable with the idea of a letter vote at this time. I just am not comfortable with that based on everything that I've heard or read on this case. And I like what the idea of moving in more time on this job, which, you know, has got the promotion possible and all that stuff. I understand that, but I think a little bit more time should be included in his employment with the same company, a little bit of basis for stability. So this time I'm not in favor of where it's going to be.
Mr. Rittenhouse?
I don't have anything to add that hasn't been said.
So I am going to, and before I make this motion, let me say when we finish up on our conclusion that all of the supporters, please go out this door to my right, your left, and all the victims, please go out the door to my left, your right, when you're going out that door. I do want to say that this has probably been one of the most emotionally stressed things, and that everyone will have emotional feelings that they have, but I would only ask that everyone be respectful of each other in these times. So I'm going to make a motion to deny Mr. Buckingham regular parole or absolute discharge and continue him on home arrest. I am going to also ask for a 1-year set off on this incident. That's going to be my motion at this time.
Second.
Agreed.
The motion by myself, second by Mr. Neal. Agreed. Mr. Quinones, Mr. Rittenhouse. I did ask for a 1-year set off. I'm going to mark that the reasons for a denial is that it was a serious and violent offense, loss of human life. So those are going to be the reason for the denial, unless the board has some additional things that they want to say. Okay. No other comments. That's going to conclude the hearing. Again, I'm going to ask the supporters to go to the door to my right and left. The victims go to the door out my left, your right. I do want to thank everyone for taking the opportunity and time to come down and appear before this board at this time. That's going to conclude the hearing.